Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. On today's show, we're going to talk about whose voice gets heard, how groups get counted or ignored. That happens in college admissions. It happens in stand-up comedy and slam poetry. And it's happening right now in the Seattle mayoral race with groups of people wondering how their voice is going to count. Let's bring in, with the counting, KUOW politics reporter Amy Radel. Hi, Amy.
Hi there.
So Seattle did some more counting today after that close election on Tuesday. They've been counting ever since. And what have we learned?
Not as much as people want, because yesterday's results didn't include yet that primary day rush to the ballot box, to the drop box, and to the votes that got mailed in on Tuesday. So we don't know kind of that kind of sentiment yet. These are still ballots that were mailed in before Tuesday. So Crosscut had an interview with the spokesman of King County Elections, and he called Wednesday's results the bummer day because we're all anxious for more information, but we don't quite get it. And they also have a map by zip code of the turnout, and we are seeing higher turnout north of the Ship Canal, but also Rainier Valley and the Central District by zip code.
Okay, so you have zip code turnout, you have older ballots, you have fresher ballots. Do we know who all this is supposed to favor as we wonder who the two nominees for mayor are going to be?
So we know that Jenny Durkin will definitely be in the general election. And so she had a strong showing that wasn't changed very much by yesterday's results. Mm-hmm. So Carrie Moon and Nikita Oliver are very much in limbo. Carrie Moon was second place. Nikita Oliver was third. The distance between them widened slightly. Carrie Moon got about 500 more votes to her benefit yesterday. But she issued a statement saying, you know, we're not claiming victory. And then she said, it's going to take all of us working together to ensure our city's future is not sold to the highest bidder. And I kind of read that as maybe an indirect swipe at Jenny Durkin because she raised the most money and had the most donors in the primary.
Oh, yes. That's a conversation we'll be having a lot this fall. So let's talk about the third place vote getter. What's Nikita Oliver saying?
And she obviously has the most at stake as these results are counted. I talked to her before these new results were added yesterday. She talked about being focused on building her movement, win or lose. But at the same time, she made it clear that she is in this to win.
You know, it's really anyone's game. There are going to be ballots that are going to need to be chased down that for whatever reason were disqualified. And so it's really still up in the air.
She is not endorsing anyone or making any kinds of concessions. You know, we're waiting for new results to be posted. But she did say that between the two frontrunners so far, Carrie Moon and Jenny Durkin, Nikita Oliver's positions have more in common with Carrie Moon's.
You know, I think it's important to align with the candidate that is going to really serve the interests of the most vulnerable in our city, and of the two that are currently looking like they'll move through primaries. Carrie is the one that has shown to have the strongest analysis around what that means and the most willingness to be corrected when she's wrong.
And Moon has always been very complimentary of Oliver and saying that she is bringing an important social justice movement into local politics. So the regard is mutual. And maybe we kind of see the outlines of some kind of an anti-Durkin coalition starting in these types of comments.
Yes. And so how many ballots are still out there, Amy, waiting to be counted?
So the county estimates that they've counted about 60% of the anticipated returns. You know, they anticipated turnout maybe being in the 30%. It might end up being more in the 20% of registered voters are going to return their ballot for this primary. But there is a lot of anticipation around today's results, so we might get just more of a sense of what happened on primary day in terms of the energy around that.
It sounds like we're assuming that Justin Farrell, Bob Hasegawa, Mike McGinn are out of the running. Do we know which remaining candidate might get the votes from their supporters?
It'll be interesting to see if there's really just kind of if all the other candidates unite around whoever emerges in second place, or whether there's more of a flow, some people to Jenny Durkin, some supporters. I think organized labor is going to be really interesting because SEIU 775 endorsed Durkin. The Seattle Teachers Union endorsed Nikita Oliver. A lot of labor endorsements went to Farrell and Hasegawa. So I think it'll be interesting to watch and see who gets the benefit of those endorsements as they will flow to the finalists.
Right. And there's endorsements, and then there's actual get-out-the-vote enthusiasm, right? There's this still open question. Let's say if Moon were to finish second, how much active support that turns into votes would she get from those other supporters? Or Oliver, the same question.
And she didn't have a lot of people canvassing and knocking on doors for her in the primary. I mean, she admitted that her campaign was different. She might not have long ties with some of these groups. So it'll be interesting to see but it's going to be a very passionate race. So I'm guessing there will be a lot of people knocking on doors.
More ballots coming this afternoon? More counting?
Yeah, 4:30. By 4:30, it should be up.
Okay, Amy Radel, covering politics for you here at KUOW. Thanks again, Amy.
Yeah, thank you.
It's The Record, back in a moment. KUOW's The Record. You have, I'm sure, noticed the blanket of smoke covering us here in Western Washington, and it's coming from the wildfires in Canada. We talked to Vaughn Palmer about that yesterday on the show. There are more than 20 fires burning in BC right now. How did smoke from fires in Canada end up here? Because that doesn't always happen. And how come the smoke lingers? Sverry Vedel is a professor of environmental science at University of Washington School of Medicine. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you.
Why are we getting all this Canadian smoke?
Well, it's an unusual sort of circumstance. Normally at this time of year, the wind direction is to the east, but it isn't now. It's actually to the west and to the south. And coupled with that is, of course, the obvious heat wave that we're having, which reflects the fact that there's a high pressure phenomenon going on, and that basically translates into air that does not disseminate or disperse well. So the air is sort of trapped here at the same time. So it's a confluence of three things. It's the wildfires, it's the temperature, and it's the wind direction. And it doesn't happen very often, but when it does, we get situations like this.
Does the smoke cool the heat significantly?
No, it really doesn't have much effect on that. It does degrade visibility as you're
yes, indeed.
Obviously, but
makes for some beautiful sunrises and sunsets.
Exactly, blood red.
Yes.
Yeah.
The less happy effect is on people who really the smoke really gets them. How is the smoke affecting folks here?
Well, we don't know how it's affecting them now. We have a pretty good idea of how it's affecting them, which is particularly focused on people that have pre-existing illness, particularly respiratory or lung illnesses, asthma and chronic obstructive lung disease. And somewhat surprisingly, which has been known for over 10 years now, is people with heart disease, which isn't so obvious, but is well documented that people with heart disease are affected by high particle concentrations.
What's that connection?
Well, good question. It has to do, there are many theories as to what the mechanism is, but it's one of them is that you get some sort of inflammation in the lung from breathing in particles and other pollutants, and that kind of spills over into the rest of your body. And one of the main mechanisms by which cardiovascular disease is worsened or occurs is through this inflammation in the body. So there are other possible mechanisms, but it's become more clear that over the last few years that patients with heart disease are very susceptible to air pollution exposure.
Okay. I had not heard that before. I know people with asthma or real lung problems. They know well probably to be concerned about smoke levels outside. Who else? I mean, should the general population be concerned?
Well, yes, particularly at the concentrations that have been seen in South Tacoma, Puyallup, South Park, for example. There have been concentrations that have been categorized as being unhealthy for people that are even not susceptible. So,
are those valleys?
Well, no, not necessarily. It's really just a matter of where the smoke is dispersing. There are situations where there are lower elevations and stuff where smoke might pool, but in this case it just happens to be bad luck depending on where the fires are coming or where the smoke is coming from.
Okay, so you were saying people in the worst hit areas. I was asking who ought to be concerned.
Yeah.
General population.
And mostly they are people who have underlying disease, the elderly and the very young. But at those high concentrations, one would even be concerned about people who are healthy. And it's not possible to predict who might be susceptible to that. It's really more a matter of trial and error. For example, I don't think I'm particularly susceptible. I've been in China a few times, but there may be people that do not have underlying disease that could be susceptible to these types of exposures.
How did your China experience compare to today's haze?
Well, it's quite different. Yeah. You know, for example, the high concentrations here are around what we call 150 micrograms per cubic meter of this fine particle concentration. In China, they would be, at times, have been 10 times that, mm-hmm. 1,500 or so. So what we're seeing here now is relatively commonplace in Beijing. But having said that, it's also a population that sees this day in and day out, whereas people in Seattle don't see this at all.
So you're saying people who feel generally healthy, they might have trouble with the smoke. Yet you rode your bike to work this morning. I understand.
you got some news.
You got some intel on you.
Yeah, I did. I mean, that's sort of a personal decision about what you think the risk is. And for me personally, knowing what I've been exposed to in the past and not had trouble, it's really a personal decision of what I think is pretty small risk and the positive aspect of riding in.
Yeah, I didn't feel it. I wasn't aware of it walking through campus this morning, but lucky, I hope. What about we talked about the beautiful blood red sun.
Yeah.
This morning I saw the sunrise. It was lovely.
Yeah, I did too.
You did. Did you stare a little bit longer than usual at
the
sun?
Well, yeah. I mean, you can't avoid it. And it actually it was a little more beautiful yesterday. It was bigger yesterday than it was today. I think there was a little more haze and it wasn't quite as dramatic. But I don't think there's any more risk of staring at. In fact, there may be less risk of staring at the sun now than there is under other occasions. You know, we don't typically stare at the sun.
No. Those other occasions for me are never, as my mom told me.
Exactly. But, you know, it's red because these fine particles are really efficient at scattering light, and they preferentially scatter light in low wavelengths, which is blue light. So they scatter the blue light, and what's left is the red and orange, and resulting in this beautiful color.
So you think it's safe to look a little bit at the sun?
I wouldn't say it's safe, but probably the hazard of you glance a little bit is probably not too bad.
Okay. Yeah. Sverry Vidal, am I saying that right?
Vidal.
Vidal. Yeah. Sverry Vidal, professor of environmental science at University of Washington School of Medicine. Thanks for looking at the sun just a little bit with us and telling us about China and biking and where the haze is coming from. I hope it clears. I hope our friends who have asthma, lung problems, you know, and everybody out there is safe and cool enough as well this week. Right. Thanks for your time.
I agree. Thank you. My pleasure.
KUOW's The Record. We'll be back in a moment. A little bit later on today's show, we're going to be talking about ethnic stereotypes. Apu and the Mooch. Here's another stereotype I bet you've heard. From the TV show Parks and Recreation, this is the character Leslie Knope scoffing at poetry slams.
Anything can be a slam poem if you say it like this. It's pointless.
Yeah. Ian Martinez and Elisa Chavez have heard that one a lot. They're members of Seattle's Rain City slam poetry team. And Ian says, of course, there's some truth to that joke, but
that's kind of our joke to make about ourselves.
Okay. Not okay for outsiders.
Not okay for PH
you don't
poets.
Need that joke.
You don't need that joke. And I think secondly, yeah, it's something, there is something about the intonation and something about the delivery style that for especially a younger or less experienced spoken word poet that can be kind of canned and cliche. But I think spoken word poets are still some of the most thrilling and unique and interesting and not predictable performers and artists out there nationally, especially some of the real great ones we have in this area.
Where does this intonation, where does that even come from? Do you know?
For me, where I see a lot of that style coming from is out of the Beats and also out of like late 80s, early 90s, like some hip hop.
Is there a difference between a rapper and a spoken word poet?
I think there's a huge difference. And in fact, while rhyming can be used to great effect by fabulous poets, like the very best poets can drop, especially like internal rhyme or alliterative rhyme into a poem. Generally speaking, rhyming in a slam environment can often be perceived as a little bit corny, frankly. To the extent that there's wordplay, it's often around double meanings of words or double, triple quadruple meanings of phrases, the way we take certain things for granted. And I'll tell you, I'm only about one year less experienced than Elisa, but my first ever slam that I attended as a audience member, I saw Elisa do a whole breakdown of the word exotic in a poem, and I just like fell in love with that. And to me, that's the slam equivalent of rhyming, which is there is a game, there is a technique, but it's not what rapping is. It's a very different technique entirely.
Elisa, do you want to do the exotica that Ian fell in love with?
Exotic, adjective, very different, strange, or unusual. Of a plant or animal not living or growing naturally in a particular area from another part of the world. Used in a sentence, I love your dreadlocks. They're so different, strange, and unusual. Exotic, adjective. Of a plant or animal not living or growing naturally in a particular area from another part of the world. Used in a sentence, your skin is so exotic, I could confuse it for orchids, a mud-slumming fish. Your eyes remind me of travel brochures. They remind me you belong 1,000 miles away. Exotic. Strikingly, enticingly, or mysteriously different or unusual, as in flavor. See also, man in the dance club who told Roshni, I love your Indian spice, used her as punctuation in his death sentence. Girl, you're so exotic I could be your cartographer. Call me railroad, call me planted flag. I could mount you on the wall to show the world. Forget where you came from, you're a trophy now. Exotic. Second definition, archaic. Foreign, alien. Boy, you're so exotic, I gotta ask to see your papers. Girl, you're so alien, you're out of this world, smuggled past definitions and state lines in the beds of old trucks. Your alien appeals to the archetype in me, the arch of your back, a reminder of everything my ancestors trampled to get me where I am. Exotic. A series of expectations created by those disappointed there are no new continents to conquer. See also, a masturbatory fantasy. You say I shouldn't get so angry about these things. Who wants to be usual? Who wants to be default setting, brick and mortar, unassailably a person? You get angry. What right do my dead orchid hands have to take trinkets away from you? Well, North Star, feel free to call exotic adulation. And when I call you ignorant, relax. I mean it as a compliment.
Elisa, where did that come from for you?
Well, there's some stuff in it that really happened to me or to my friends. And it's, I think there was like, there's been like a lot of debate around certain words and like what they mean to people. And exotic, even my mom was arguing with me and my sister saying, it's fine, I think it's fine. And I wouldn't actually yell this at somebody if they said exotic about someone else. But I did think, I was thinking about, well, if you really tease out the subtext, what do people mean when they say that?
Do you get called exotic?
You know, I have been told that I am, I look more maybe like racially ambiguous. So everybody kind of sees a little bit of whatever they want to. So like the lady at the Greek bakery is like, are you Greek? And I'm like, I just want to buy a cookie. I'm sorry. But occasionally, mostly the eyebrows.
Why? How do you live your eyebrows?
Yeah. You know, when I was younger, I used to get made fun of for a lot of my body hair, and it wasn't necessarily that the kids knew that I was Latina. They weren't like being jerks for that reason, but they knew like it was different. And I refused to pluck my eyebrows when I was a middle schooler because it hurt. And my mom once took me into her room and showed me a picture of Frida Kahlo and said, Elisa, this is Frida Kahlo. She's an amazing Mexican artist. She's a beautiful woman. And in Mexico, women with mustaches and eyebrows are often regarded as beautiful. Elisa, we are not in Mexico. And I was like,
wow.
This inspirational story just went really different than I thought it was going to
yeah,
go.
Yeah, that took a turn. That's a slam poetry turn right there.
Yes, sort of there you go, a turn. That's a great, that's something, that's a device that you can use.
Ian, you loved that poem.
I sure did.
What did it do for you?
Well, I think we live in a hybrid space, both of us. And so we've been able to write a little bit to that topic and being perceived a certain way versus being a certain way versus maybe you're not what does it even mean to be a certain way? Is that just self-delusion? And so when I first heard that poem, that was one of the most inspiring moments I had to that point with interacting with at that point as an audience member with spoken word. And I've been able to access that exact feeling and that exact motion in some of my own work as well.
Will you give us one, Ian?
Sure, I'll do something on a similar topic if that's okay.
Yeah.
This is called Acura. I was the only one that ever drove Rob's car. Souped up trim, spoiler, double clutch, fuel injection, four-door racing, speed. Asians love Acuras, he said. Filipinos are gearheads, he told me, handing over his make and model like so much license and registration. Often we drove all night, trading sleep for sunrises with pretty girls that liked Rob's Acura. We never drove drunk. We almost never drove drunk. We whip crack careened in that midnight chariot. I, Martinez, New Yorican, light of skin and slight of frame. He, Casimiro, Filipino, body long and dark like the shadow of our shared history. Two bastard stepsons living privileged, dizzy with Spanish surnames and all those white girls who loved Rob's car. But Rob had a lead foot. See, tickets for him were the price of life in six speeds, and I think the Virginia State Police call it a routine traffic stop because it happens so routinely to people who look like Rob. Seen. He isn't going that fast. I've seen him go faster. But I'll tell you who was. The cop who suspends Rob's license before he can hand it over, who asks him, "Do you know how fast you were going, son?" And of course he does. Rob knows this car like his own body, but an honest answer might cost him both. So he, "No, sirs, and I lost track on the way home, sirs," just as Sergeant Stars and Stripes realizes he's already a slave to paperwork. And the white boy with the license just might be his savior. The twinkle in his eye is zippity-doo-dah when he says, "Son, we're going to take your friend's car unless maybe you could drive it home." His smile is sweet tea when I say yes, when I hand him my license, when I ask him to deem me passable. If our shared history is one of cultural rape, what am I to make of my resemblance to the rapist? You know, they say silence is deafening, but they don't tell you that's because your ears fill with the last thing you heard. How do you pronounce that last name, son? I don't surprise myself when I answer him with a question, because the right answer is not the correct one. Martinez? Son, he says, straightening my question mark into a razor-sharp exclamation point, I'm gonna have to search you. When the virtuous bigot is done recolonizing our bodies, he hands me Rob's keys like a conquistador's lance, hands me permission to drive Rob's car like it was his to give in the first place. As I cross the car to take the wheel, my knees are patriotic wobbly because the 90-second whiplash from "you're one in a million" to "you're one of them" to "you're one of the good ones" is a uniquely American way to feel vertigo. I was the only one that ever drove Rob's car, but never with his consent.
True story?
True story, yeah. Actually, a real thing that happened in my life and some version of it many times over.
Talking with New Yorican Ian Martinez, Elisa Chavez as well from Rain City Poetry Slam. You've said people with marginalized identities have a place in slam poetry. Why is that?
Slam poetry is weird, and it's informal on purpose. And in some ways, it was started as sort of a challenge to mainstream academic type of poetic circles. And so then you attract people who are on the fringes. And a lot of times those people are poorer and browner and younger and queerer than the people who will show up to, you know, maybe more established literary events. And, you know, there's a couple of things, I think of listening to your poem, Ian. Whenever anybody asks me why slam poetry, you know, if it's not vetted, if it's not, you know, if there's no guarantee of quality, if there's no gatekeeping, why would you go? The first time that I was in a room when Ian delivered that line about the whiplash and how it's a uniquely American way to feel vertigo, the room went wild. People screamed and cheered and hit tables. I don't know if you remember if you were in the zone, but I was there and that's what happened. And I would like, when is the last time you heard of that happening at a poetry reading? You know, we have members of our community who very bravely and graciously get up on our stage and share a little bit of their experiences with us. They give us these little windows that we wouldn't get anywhere else.
Yeah, and that's across, you know, to your question about why slam for marginalized, that's across really anything. I mean, there are people who occupy extremely kind of, what's the opposite of marginalized, you know?
Me?
Yeah, right. You would be welcome there too.
Would I like on stage?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
And it's, you know, not that it's to the exclusion of anyone. It's that it's to the inclusion of everyone and actually being conscious about holding a space for folks who don't get to speak at literary events, or for that matter, most political events, board meetings, X, Y, Z.
Radio stations?
Radio stations. I don't know, but I assume probably. Yeah, not too many like trans people of color, right, hosting their own shows. And so it's really just about opening space for that, not excluding anyone at all.
Do you consider yourself marginalized?
I consider myself extremely privileged, but I come from a background in this country, you know, being Latino in particular, and we dabble with that a lot, actually. You exist on the kind of borders, no pun intended, but pun fully intended, of society, of access to privilege, and being, you know, being, for example, a light-skinned Latino, but being a light-skinned Latino who almost has to be that much more on guard, because every time a police officer sees your license, they're going to do a complete 180 on you. It's predictable, right? You can count on it. Do I consider myself marginalized? That's a very difficult question, but I think a lot of folks, whether they consider themselves marginalized or not, who maybe don't always have access to just a comfortable space to kind of rant and rave, right? Even if it's not quote unquote superior poetry, find a home in slam. And so I think subject matter, be it about identity, be it about class, be it about all the isms we talk about, actually, this is a place where people can commiserate and actually feel a little bit of joy around inverting that narrative in their lives.
Can you do a poem together, the two of you?
We can give it a try and see if it works.
Yeah.
Let's hear some poetry harmony.
Do it.
All right. Las monjas quitaron el español desde los labios de mi abuelo una barría a la vez.
Nuns knocked the Spanish from my grandfather's lips one switch at a time. Así mis abuelos decidieron que el español no era el hogar de sus hijos.
So my grandparents decided Spanish was no home for their children, and we had to move.
When you move home across the border,
se traduce atravesar la frontera. When the border moves across your home, se traduce vivir la vida fronteriza. Traducir, to translate. See also, trasladar,
which, as my grandmother never taught me, also means
to move. Trasladar, see also, mover.
Avanzar,
mudar,
which apparently also means to move your household.
Mudarse, see also, moverse, trasladarse, traducir.
My grandmother never taught me these words because she didn't believe in giving me gifts that hurt. But these days, everyone I meet wants to see my grandpa's welts.
Yeah. No, abra la boca, menos.
Don't open your mouth unless your accent is flawless. No te atreves a.
Don't you dare utter that foreign tongue unless you can speak for everyone else who speaks it. ¿Qué te hace calificado para llevar
de carga
de nuestra historia,
de
nuestra gente? If this is hard for you to listen to, try living it.
If you can't speak it,
you can't be it. If you speak it too well, it's all you'll ever be.
Cuando
se mispronuncia
el español,
se uses
palabras
like mispronunciar y
mispronunciar no.
That's a word.
En español y no.
Really, in inglés tampoco.
Freaking Siri
has
a better
accent than
me. Having the Spanish beat out of you is one of the most American things a Spanish speaker can experience.
Fear of Spanish is one of the most authentic ways to be Latino. They taught my grandfather to fear his own voice. Now his grandchildren speak perfect conqueror. Mira el frase de jalo de los labios para fuera.
I spend hours staring in the mirror trying to figure out
who
my
face
belongs
to. Mientras me veo. Metaslado conquistador se traduce.
The subtle murder of my culture from within starts with an act of the lips.
Como mudarse.
How they move themselves, but the world reads
whatever they
want
to. Those nuns punished my grandfather.
Made Spanish the apple,
our culture the snake. If God is in the word, does my lack of words keep me from heaven? Can this forked tongue ever be holy? English planted a garden of pain and doubt.
I don't know what will grow here.
El inglés plantó un jardín de dudas y dolor.
No sé lo que creciera aquí.
So we will build our home with two foundations.
Así construyemos.
Nuestro hogar de dos fundaciones simplemente toma la alegría de hablar.
Es un acto intraducible.
Simply taking joy in speaking is an untranslatable act.
That is Ian Martinez and Elisa Chavez from Seattle's Rain City Slam Poetry Team, and they just read you the poem Poema Nacional. Elisa wrote that poem about her relationship with Spanish, with all its mess and sadness and humor and joy, as she told me. They're going to be performing Poema Nacional at the National Slam Poetry Competition in Denver on Saturday, August 12th. We are going to keep talking about the American melting pot, so-called, race in college admissions, and the ethnic humor around Apu and the Mooch coming up on KUOW's The Record. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. Intentional race-based discrimination. That's the language Attorney General Jeff Sessions is using to describe affirmative action admissions policies at American universities. The Department of Justice appears to be focusing on suing some schools with affirmative action admission policies, claiming those policies have allowed colleges to discriminate against white and Asian American students. The Department of Justice could look at Washington State as a test case. We outlawed affirmative action admission policies at colleges back in 1998. That was done by initiative. And my next guest was an advisor on that initiative campaign, UCLA Law School professor Eugene Volokh. Welcome to KUOW.
Good to be on.
You have said that race-based admissions are bad for white students and minority students. Why do you say that?
Well, they involve race discrimination. They treat some students worse, generally not just because they're white, but because they're Asian or because they're white. They purport to help black and Hispanic students. In many situations, I'm not sure they do, among other things, because a lot of these policies let in students who really, whose predictors, whose grades and whose test scores suggest they will not succeed well in the institution. So to give an example, there were some studies in the late 1990s and early 2000s which suggested that in law schools, that's the field I know best because I'm a law professor, the median black student, the student at the 50% mark of all the black students within the class, was in the bottom 10% of the class. And that was largely, probably entirely, because they were let in based on race preferences. Their predictor scores were less than the other students. So as a result, these students ended up being near the bottom of the class, often became dispirited, were less likely to graduate, were less likely to learn effectively, and pass the bar. Whereas if they had gone to a school where their grades actually put them more in the middle of the class, it would be much more likely they would have succeeded.
Well, let's
so
talk
I think
about
on balance, I think the race-based preferences are not a good idea as a policy matter, but I also think that they're wrong, just as discrimination against blacks and Hispanics is wrong. I think discrimination against Asians and whites based on the race is wrong as well.
Okay, let's talk more about this. Also with us, Dr. Jim Sultan, Jr., former executive director of the Washington Higher Education Coordinating Board. Welcome.
Thank you.
Since this anti-affirmative action law in Washington State passed 20 years ago from this initiative, how is race considered in college admissions in Washington today?
Well, I'm no longer with the Higher Education Coordinating Board, so I'm a little bit humble to speak on that, particularly the way you phrased it. But I can say that based on the programmatic approach that was put in place in this state following the passage of I-202, it depends on the institution. And of course, all eyes are on the University of Washington and its law school to see how it is addressing the issue. But I must say that the previous comment got my attention. As the father of two African-American law students, I want to assure the professor that there are a lot of students out there, students of color, that is, who can pass muster, if you will, or do the work that's required to be successful in law school.
Do you think that you heard Professor Volokh saying that considering race in admissions is discriminatory, but also dispiriting was his word. Your kids aside, big picture, what do you say to that argument?
Well, after four decades of precedent, as the lawyers say, and the professor's colleague, Rachel Moran, is in the news again today saying the same thing, that is pretty much a smokescreen kind of argument. And you understand that the matters that have been brought to the fore have sometimes been political grandstanding, like the Department of Justice is doing these days under Jeff Sessions with its latest move. There are really no reasons underlying those arguments empirically or subjectively to substantiate them. The fact of the matter is that we understand racial discrimination is a part of American history in higher education. The discrepancies, the disproportionality, the disparities that exist were not done by accident. They were done with intent. They were done by segregationists whom apparently this current administration embraces. But nonetheless, they will not be eradicated except by the same thing, by purpose, by intention. And so the efforts that have been put underway to make these things happen are intentional, but they are not racially preferential. They are not quota-oriented. They are not all of the criticisms that have been leveled against them.
Professor Volokh, would you acknowledge that we don't have a level playing field outside of race-based admissions?
There are lots of injustices in the world. The question is, to what extent adding extra injustices is the solution to them? So here you're telling, for example, in many of these programs, you're telling Asian students, some of them whose parents just came to the country or who themselves came to the country, or poor white students or many others who themselves have not engaged in race discrimination, often have not themselves benefited from race discrimination, you're saying, well, sorry, you are of a racial group that we've labeled an oppressor racial group, or in the Asian context, at least you are not of the racial groups that we're trying to favor. So as a result, we're going to deliberately discriminate against you based on race. The motivation may be to try to correct past injustices, but the way it's being done is by creating current injustices. Let me give you, by the way, a story. This happened probably about 15 years ago. Somebody, an Asian student as it happens, had just graduated from a top law school. And he was talking to me, and he said, one of the things that we found in my school is that we, when deciding whether to enroll in a class, we wanted to see if it would be a class with lots of really top students, because then we might get worse grades as a result, because the classes are graded on the curve. So we looked to see if there were lots of black and Hispanic students in that class. And because we knew that black and Hispanic students, because of the race-based preferences, the black and Hispanic students were likely to have pretty poor grades, that was the class we'd enroll in because we'd know that we would therefore end up getting better grades. That's a very corrosive system, but it was created not because I think he was prejudiced against black and Hispanic students, not because he was just kind of making stuff up. He was acting perfectly rationally. Once you publicly announce that you are preferring black and Hispanic students who have lower predictors, who are less likely to succeed, then what the message you're sending is to white and Asian students and to other black and Hispanic students, you look at your classmates, you could tell a lot about their likely success in school based on their skin color.
Okay,
so that's just one of the ways in which the system is corrosive.
Dr. Sultan, any response?
It's amazing to listen to this fictional generalization the professor is making on the basis of a single Asian American student. It may be a anecdote that he enjoys telling, but he's extrapolating in a very awful way. I would invite him to walk around his own campus or any Big Ten or Big 12 campus, Pac-12, I'm sorry, and then see whether or not it is teeming with black and Latino students who have been enrolled there at the expense of white students, at the expense of Asian American students. I don't think that he can substantiate what he's saying based on reality, but I can. And what I'm saying based on reality is that as I look in the paper today and I read about historically black colleges and universities trying to adjust their mission just so that they can survive, I understand historically that they have been there because students were not allowed into predominantly white institutions. And I'm sitting here in 2017 struck by the reality that they are still not being allowed into predominantly white institutions, including the law schools, including the engineering programs. And so to suggest that this might be better done, this admissions process that we're speaking about, might be better done if it were done on the basis of meritocratic principles is a good suggestion. And then I would invite him to see how many white students in comparison with Asian American, with comparison with Latinos and Black American students he finds in his engineering education programs. I would venture to guess that it would be fewer white students. I would also ask the same for business administration or any of the specialized degree programs that the institutions are offering, because this admissions thing is not just admissions into undergraduate education. It's admissions into higher education, and it is discriminatory, it's institutionally racist, and it is wrong. And for the initiative that came out yesterday to be pronounced the way it was is just awful.
Dr. Jim Sultan Jr., former executive director of the Washington Higher Education Coordinating Board, and from UCLA, Professor Eugene Volokh, law school professor there. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We've been discussing the initiative from the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, who has been talking about suing some schools with admission policies that take race into account. We'll continue to follow that story for you here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. I'm white. I grew up in the 70s seeing ethnic stereotypes. Aunt Jemima, Hong Kong Phooey, Frito Bandito. Eventually, I would find out why they made people uncomfortable, and then they'd make me uncomfortable. Then in 1990, The Simpsons introduced the character Apu, the Indian-American Quickie Mart manager.
Can't believe you have to work Christmas Eve.
Well, if you are here for a last-minute gift, we have a cell phone holder that fits no cell phone made after 2002, and a Quickie Nog. Nog stands for not okayed by government.
I'm going to be honest with you. Apu did not make me very uncomfortable. On the racist scale of 1 to 5, Apu rang 1 bell, 1.5 bells with me. Still, that's more bells than went off for me last week when I saw this.
The Mooch! Hey, it's the Mooch! Hey, baby, can we get another round over here for the Mooch, please?
Now, the Mooch, former White House Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci, didn't really talk or act like that, but hey, Italian-American caricatures are acceptable, and Apu is funny? Let's discuss with two comedians. Hari Kondabolu, formerly of Seattle, now Brooklyn, welcome back.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Good to see you again. Liz Mealy, Italian heritage from, what, 100 years ago? What are we talking?
That's a good question. I would have to talk to my family, which I try not to.
Sorry to put that on you. Performing in Seattle this weekend at Laughs Comedy Club. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. First of all, were the Mooch impressions funny to you, Liz?
I mean, that becomes a standard of stand-up comedy, which is like you have, when you're so enmeshed in comedy, you have to go a little higher than like a weird like Joey Fatone kind of wannabe impression. So on the basis level of comedy, no, none of it ever is.
Yeah. Have you ever done an exaggerated Italian-American accent?
No.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, so what would I be? I would be, so this is how bad I am. So my grandparents would came from Italy. So that would make my mom first generation and then me second generation.
Uh-huh.
So my mom doesn't know Italian, but her, you know, her parents did. But I don't know my grandparents. Like they weren't alive when I was born. So it's like there are stereotypes that do fit in and make a lot of sense. My grandparent, on my dad's side, they owned a deli. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And food to suppress feelings is still a thing. You know,
food to suppress feelings.
You know, like that's how, you know, oh, you're sad, here's a sandwich. Like it's very much,
if you're tasting, you don't have to feel quite
as much. And I still do it to this day. It's a great habit.
Uh-huh. Hari, your parents were Indian immigrants, mm-hmm. right? You have a new documentary called The Problem with Apu,
mm-hmm.
a film you wouldn't have to make if there weren't people like me. sorry about that. I've learned a bit since 1990, sure. but what's the problem with Apu?
I mean, the big thing is at the time, he was the only major representation on mainstream American television and media of Indian Americans. And he was also voiced by a white guy with brown paint, which is historically how minstrels work. And when the other major characters you've seen of Indians were also played by white guys, and the ones that were played by brown people were also stereotypical and limited, you know, that shapes how, you know, a whole group of people gets viewed, right? There was no balance. I think it's different than the Scaramucci example, first of all, because Scaramucci is a political figure also, that's being satirized. He calls himself the Mooch, as we've heard in The New Yorker. And also, like, Italian Americans have historically had more images, right? I'm not saying all the images are positive, but they've had more images, and Italian Americans can kind of, you know, and have historically blended into whiteness, right?
Right.
You don't even know someone's Italian sometimes or has that heritage, as opposed to if you have brown skin, it's not, you can't really do that. There's even been Supreme Court cases to show that, you know, we're not seen as Caucasian by the law. So that being said, you know, it's a completely different situation because of that.
How did you feel, Apu, personally?
I mean, you know, there's a difference between something being funny and something also being, you know, something can be funny and something can still be wrong. To me, Apu is so singular. It's not a great impression. It's so one-dimensional. Everything about him gets viewed with this lens of an outsider. You know, for me, it's like, you're talking about my parents.
Yeah.
You know, these are my parents. You know, I'm sure when my parents talk and people walk away, like, are they laughing at their accents? I mean, I've seen people do impressions of other people's accents. And also, I think about, like, when you have a limited number of images as a minority group, it's scary, right? Like, you want to be seen as a full human. And let's say post 9/11, what do we have? We have Apu, which is a harmless figure, and terrorists, which are a harmful figure. And if you only have two major images that, like, resonate with people, when you're scared, which one do you go to? And so to me, you know, Apu is also part of a larger problem of representation and how we see minority groups.
Liz, you weren't thinking that the Simpsons character Luigi was making fun of your spaghetti chef father.
Well, you also have to put things in context where...
By the way, just in case our listeners don't know Luigi...
Here comes a greaseball!
Hey, Luigi, bring your kids a free pizza. Why you have to make the fun, huh?
And then, by the way, there's also a mobster on The Simpsons named Fat Tony.
Ah, my joisy muscle. It's so good to see you. Did you have a nice flight, Johnny Tight Lips?
I ain't saying nothing.
Let's do this thing.
By the way, Fat Tony voiced by Italian-American actor Joe Mantegna.
Yeah. I have to always put things in perspective of I've never had, for the most part, to think about my race. I mean, I am actually very ethnically ambiguous looking. I have big curly hair. I actually get Spanish most of the time. Most people think I'm Puerto Rican. Uh-huh. I get half black, half white. I get Middle Eastern. My best friend's Egyptian. We look identical.
Yeah.
So for me.
What's that like?
Well, it's actually kind of funny. I don't know if the joke is okay, but I always thought, like, how many opportunities have I missed because people don't know I'm white?
Right.
You know,
yeah.
You know what I mean? But I
if only.
But it's there's so many diversity, like, contests and comedy where people are like, you're Spanish, right? And I go, no. And then they walk away and I'm like, oh, man. But for me, I always have to remember that I, like Hurry said, like, I don't have to think in that context, like, because there's so many different representations. I don't see myself as just Italian. I mean, I don't know if I walk around seeing myself as white unless it becomes, are we talking about privilege? Are we talking about, I mean, if anything, I walk around seeing myself as a woman. So when you think about these things, because I've had so many more representations, whether it's being Italian, whether it's being a white person, whether it's how I'm digested by people, I think in a lot of ways I would see something like that and I go, well, that doesn't relate to me, and I would walk away.
You two perform together. Have you kind of cross-pollinated about your humor? Like, oh, you've learned from each other, rewritten jokes together?
I mean, Hurry's kept me in check a lot.
One example, please.
I have a newish joke. I performed all over the Middle East for the troops last summer. And I was talking about my experiences because, again, being a woman, I had to be covered from the neck down. I was with three other male comics. I was told that I couldn't be in the back of the line. Like, I always had to be surrounded by men. I had to be walked to the bathroom. It was, you know, really something. I mean, I slightly deal with it as a woman that walks home 2 a.m. after a gig by herself. But it's the first time that it felt like 2 a.m. all the time, everywhere I went. And I felt really uncomfortable. So I wrote jokes about being in the Middle East, going through security, and what that felt like. And I actually remember we did a bunch of gigs. I think it was in Indianapolis or right outside of Indianapolis. And we were at lunch and he said that there was a line that he didn't like, that he didn't think said that I was stereotyping, and I actually—
Can you tell it to us, or are you putting it behind you?
No,
to be perfectly honest,
I don't do it anymore, therefore I don't completely remember it, and that's kind of how my joke writing works. As soon as a joke morphs, it's no longer remembered because I have too much to remember. But he talked about it, and he kept explaining it to me, and I was being perfectly honest. It was a very safe space because I know Hari loves me, and we've been friends forever. But I kept saying, I don't understand. And it was this thing where he didn't understand why I didn't understand, but I didn't understand. And finally, I was able to go, well, fix the joke. Just tell me how to fix it. And he gave me the line. And when he told me how to fix it, I immediately understood what he had a problem with. And it, like, I can't explain it, but I wish more people had the ability to write out their thoughts and have them morphed like that, because I honestly didn't understand why he had a problem with it, and it, and we couldn't see eye to eye as much as he explained, and then he fixed the joke, and all of a sudden everything he was saying made sense to me. And now,
do you remember this, Hari?
I remember this, and I think, you know, we have such a good friendship because we have such an open dialogue, and that's the reason we tour together, and we certainly influence each other. I mean, she's an incredibly good joke writer. I'm excited about this weekend at Laughs because I know that Seattle's going to love what I love about her, which is like really thoughtful, well-written pieces. And I feel like I'm a better joke writer because of her. And I feel like we've challenged each other performing for each other's crowds. So it's been, it's, you know.
We were talking about Apu a moment ago. The comedian Margaret Cho used to do her parents with the Korean accent. And from what I know of your act, you make a point of not impersonating your parents.
One, I don't do a good impression of my parents to begin with. And
no better than Azaria, maybe a little better,
I do an impression of Hank Azaria's impression of Indian people. I mean, that's, you know, I was born and raised here, and I definitely have lived all over the place, so that, you know, I can't, my voice is what it is. But I think with Margaret Cho, I think it's different because she was the first. When you're the first of something, it's huge. Not only was she like the first big, you know, Korean-American stand-up comic, she also was talking about her mom and humanizing her. Like in the first special, I'm the One I Want, she talks about their struggle without, you know, with their father living in Korea and how it was just, you know, the two of them and their brother and her brother and what that was like. I mean, she humanizes her mother. And also, I think she takes ownership. It's different when you take ownership and if you give your parents depth. And also, again, she was the first. I think it's different when you start a trajectory versus where we are right now.
But she also knows what she's doing. Because it's her parents, because it's her heritage. Like when it's you saying, like you said, giving somebody, making humanizing, but I'm also giving them a context so that everybody can know what it feels like to be raised by your mother specifically. And then you kind of take something that's very specific and make it more broad. You know, most people are laughing because moms are crazy.
Yeah.
All of them. It doesn't matter what culture they're from, and how she exudes that is unique to how she grew up. But at the end of the day, the message is that her mom is crazy.
Yeah.
And I think that's what people kind of come together. We all have moms.
Hari, you're trying to get laughs. Do you have any fear of being labeled shrill or PC when you're also in the business of entertaining?
I mean, I'm going to be called that regardless. You know, I get called that before people even hear my act. You know what I mean? Because when you're talking about big issues, just the idea that this person talks about this, this, and this, it's where I've been called both politically correct and also politically incorrect. Uh-huh. I've been called too soft and also way too edgy. Because I'll talk about really big topics that are abrasive and harsh, and at the same time, I find a way to talk about it that shares my point of view, and I definitely think about social justice and what is right. So, you know, for some people, even going to that subject matter is politically correct as opposed to my well-thought-out opinions, not just, like, knee-jerk reactions. And for other people, the fact that I'm going there makes them uncomfortable. The fact that I talk about whiteness as a construction and I talk about, like, what it means when white is the standard, that makes people think that I'm totally, you know, going off the rails. So it depends on who they are. And I'm, as long as I'm being honest with my point of view, I'm good with it.
Liz, who can we agree it's okay to make fun of?
I mean, honestly, I think you should be able to make fun of anybody and everybody. I fully believe no subject is off topic. I just think some need more thoughtfulness, and I think some deserve more skill.
And context.
Actually, I don't even like that question. Is it okay to so-and-so? Because it sort of puts comedians in the role of being the thought police, oppressing the good white people with your, you know, with your finger wagging. What's okay and what's not okay?
I mean, there's no thought police. Otherwise, I would be arresting people left and right, Bill. I mean, we're talking about debates. I could say what I feel an opinion, right? Then the other person says, I disagree with your opinion. If you start talking about thought policing and political correctness, you've eliminated the ability to go back and forth. I'm not the government. I can't tell you what to say. If you criticize me for the art I create, of course I'm going to be hurt and upset. But then I respond, and my job is to criticize things and look at the world. So how can I be upset when somebody criticizes me?
Would you be upset if I told you we're out of time?
Yeah.
Okay, that's crossing a line. But I have to tell you that. Hurry Kondabolo, formerly of Seattle, happy to have you back from Brooklyn.
Absolutely.
Thanks for
Thank
coming.
Thank you, Bill.
Liz Mealy is performing in Seattle starting tomorrow night?
Tonight.
Friday night? Tonight.
Yeah.
Thursday night.
Yeah.
And Friday, Saturday, Sunday?
Not Sunday.
Not Sunday. I didn't do that very elegantly. At Laughs Comedy Club in Seattle. Liz and Hurry, it's great to see you both.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot. KUOW is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. See you tomorrow.